This is Chatter. I'm Matt Gluck. This week, journalist David Sanger on New Cold Wars.
You cannot live in both the American camp and the Chinese camp, which is what G42 was trying to do. You can either be in one camp or you can be in the other. And that has essentially been the policy of the Biden administration. The President of the United States was talking about the prospect of the first wartime use of a nuclear weapon since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and not at some vague moment in the future. He meant in the next few weeks. These new Cold Wars we are in are very different from the old. In the old Cold War, we had one major military, largely nuclear competitor, the Soviet Union. There was a predictability to it. That's gone in this era. We are at once dependent on China and they are dependent on us. And yet we are no longer confident that that alone will keep us from going into conflict.
David Sanger, welcome to the show. Congratulations on your excellent book. To get us started, could you broadly describe the trajectory of your reporting career and how it led you to write The New Cold Wars?
My reporting career has been all at the New York Times. I joined soon after college, within months after college. And so I've had the pleasure of having sort of a press pass to the world for about 40 plus years now. And I was a foreign correspondent in Japan for 6 years. I came back for a 3-year assignment in Washington that is about to stretch to 30 this year. So you can see I'm sort of stuck doing what I was doing, but happily so. And it's really those 30 years that this book covers, because I came back from Japan in 1994. Bill Clinton was president. It was just before his impeachment, which, you know, seems kind of humdrum and old compared to impeachments we've gone through since, right? It was right at the height of the moment where we thought the United States was the great unipower that could basically rule the world or set the world according to its benign intentions, because China was still a rising but fundamentally emerging economy. And Russia was flat on its back. Yeltsin was trying to do his democratization thing, but, you know, was drunk half the time and unable to pull it off. And the more I was traveling around with presidents and secretaries of state and others, it became evident that we had an image in our mind of how this was going to unfold. That China and Russia, each for their very own distinct reasons, would go join the world economy on our terms, because it wasn't worth it to them to give up the remarkable market opportunities that China had with what was then low-end but increasingly sophisticated goods, and that Russia desperately needed its oil and gas revenues. It had failed to diversify its economy. And that while they both may make noises about Taiwan or Ukraine or whatever, at the end of the day, nationalism, territorial desires, images of regaining empires past, that would all fall by the wayside. And instead, you would end up with a globalized economy where freedom would seep in through the system, over the internet, through free markets. And this guided Washington for a long time. It wasn't a terrible bet at the time it started, but some combination of bad intelligence, wishful thinking, and a projection of our values onto those elsewhere in the world, I think led the United States, its leadership, and many in the West to ignore obvious signs that the world was not unfolding this way. And so every time we had a modest piece of cooperative work with one of the other superpowers, we interpreted it as evidence that our theory was right and that they really would basically roll around to an American way of doing things. Let me give you some examples. With the Russians, we reached an agreement soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall to dismantle their nuclear weapons, the ultimate expression of power. Not all of them, but thousands of them. Blend them down. We bought the resulting fuel and burned them in nuclear power plants so that people were sitting in the Midwest reading, you know, bedtime stories to their kids with fuel that previously, 10 years earlier, had been sitting in nuclear warheads aimed at them. That was a real great sign. China helped organize the six-party talks to try to restrain North Korea. China and Russia together sat on the European and American side of the table during the Iran nuclear agreements. Obama signed an arms control deal with Putin. The Chinese signed a climate deal, more than one, with Obama. So these were all the evidence that, you know, we may have different systems, but when our interests converge, we can all come together. And what were we ignoring? We underreacted when Putin went to the Munich Security Conference in 2007 and said, there are lands that once belonged to Peter the Great's Russian Empire that must be restored. Bob Gates, then the defense secretary, previously a CIA director, stood up the next day and said, you know, I have to respond. I've been through one Cold War. I don't want to go through another. But it barely really scratched the public consciousness. Then 7 years later, he took Crimea. There's a chapter on this called The Seven-Year Itch, because every 7 years, with apologies to Marilyn Monroe, he seems to, you know, get into one of these. Took Crimea. It took the West a year to put together sanctions. And the following year, Angela Merkel signs the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline deal with Putin and calls him a reliable supplier. So what was Putin supposed to think we would do when he decided to take all of Ukraine and make good on the threat he had made at Munich? And for China, it's a different story. The era of Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao were eras in which peaceful rise seemed to be, in fact, not only the Chinese mantra, but the strategy most of the time. There were some exceptions to it. But 10 years ago, when Xi came to power, we missed the signals. The intelligence reports all said he would focus on the domestic economy. He would not challenge the United States. He would not make a priority of trying to take Taiwan. He would not be highly repressive. He would follow the sort of hide and bide theory of his predecessors, particularly Jiang Zemin. And that was completely wrong. And so the book is about, first, how did we get to this intelligence failure? And then after 150 pages of this topic, it plunges into the Biden administration and how they managed two Cold Wars that bear very little resemblance to the old one.
So before we get into the Biden administration's policies and how they sought to reverse course, I want to go backwards a bit and speak about China specifically. So you explain that the U.S. thought bringing China into the U.S.-led order was an opportunity that we couldn't pass up economically because the potential was just so vast. Was this naive in the 90s and early 2000s? Or was the Clinton administration right to try to bring China into the WTO, but then perhaps the U.S. should have shifted course once China showed hostility toward the U.S. and democratic values once it was given this opportunity? In other words, when should this shift have occurred, in your view?
Right. So different answers for Russia and China. And as I suggested for Russia, I think the warning bells were going off a lot earlier in the Russian case. In the China case, look, I think we had to take this bet, first of all. I mean, I was with Clinton when he went to Beijing University, and he gave a speech, which I believed at the time, I thought was perfectly reasonable, that said, the internet will set you free, right? It will undercut the authority of the Communist Party. It will assure that the democratic values of the West will seep into China beyond the local elections that China was experimenting with at that time. And Clinton would go out and visit some of these, you know, villages just outside of Beijing where they were holding local elections for local leaders, right? And he said this to students, and the students would all clap, and then they would apply for their visas to get educated in the United States. And that was the hot thing to do. And meanwhile, during the Clinton administration, and certainly during the Bush administration, the business community saw China as the great opportunity. I mean, one reason that they saw it that way was that they had been heavily in Japan in the 80s and 90s when I was there. Japan's economy had hit the rocks. It was an extremely expensive place to live and operate. I can testify to this because I was renting a house in Tokyo at the time. It was just not the market of the future. And here was China with, you know, 1.6 billion young consumers, and that looked entirely different. People knew that the Chinese were stealing intellectual property, but they didn't really let that get in the way of their trying to get into the market, whether they were Beijing Jeep or IBM or Intel or anybody else. And of course, people wanted to manufacture there. So there was huge pressure on both Democrats and Republicans to make the China relationship work. And frankly, the warning signs weren't that great until about 10 years ago. And that's where the U.S. began to ignore the obvious.
What's your sense of the impact the U.S. engagement in the Middle East had on our posture toward China before the Trump administration? Many argue that it was primarily this focus in the Middle East that drew the U.S. away from strategic competition with China. But if the United States was deeply committed to engagement, as you show, might a stronger focus on China have produced more engagement rather than more competition?
I think it would have probably produced both. But the distractions of the war on terror were huge, right? Mind share of policymakers, but also just the focus of the U.S. military and the diplomats. You could not get promoted for 20 years in the Pentagon if you had not served in Afghanistan and Iraq. And service out in the Pacific, while valued, didn't have the value of the battle stars of being in the conflict zones. Similarly, there were rules from the Bush administration forward in the State Department that if you were going to get up on the promotion ladder there, you had to do time in Iraq after the war or in Afghanistan or in the region. And the result was that you ended up favoring expertise there from favoring expertise elsewhere. Now, every president talked about the pivot to Asia. Bush talked about it. Obama talked about it. Even Trump talked about, you know, Asia's where our future is. But the execution on that pivot was pretty poor. And there's a really interesting book on this topic coming out in the next few months from Richard Fontaine and Bob Blackwell, just looking at the topic of this. In New Cold Wars, I deal with it some. But one anecdote, really from a previous book of mine, I think sort of says it all. I was at the Central Party School in Beijing in around 2009, 2010. And this is where leaders of the Communist Party were trained. Xi Jinping ran the Central Party School for a while, or was at least its honorary chairman. And a recently retired Chinese Air Force officer sat me down and he said, you know, David, of all of the meetings I sat in about competing and taking on the United States, where we talked about how to push the U.S. back to the second island chain, or how we would keep the United States away from the South China Sea and the Philippines. I never sat in one meeting where people said, well, don't worry about the Americans. They will distract themselves in the Middle East for 20 years and keep their forces tied up there. And yet that's what we did.
You draw a nuanced distinction between the Trump administration's trade-focused policies with respect to China and the Biden administration's more comprehensive shift toward China in technological and economic policy. Could you describe how these approaches differ and how the Trump administration at least seems to have set a precedent for the Biden administration's China policy?
Look, the Biden administration doesn't want to hear it, and I can understand why they don't. But there are elements of what they have done and things that they have done successfully that lay in with the Trump administration. And that's just a fact. The tariffs that Trump put on have never been lifted, right? In fact, just in the past few days, President Biden is talking about extending them in the steel industry, exactly the kinds of things that people complained during the Trump era were protectionist policies. Now, it's an election year, and like I get it with tariffs and all that. But still, the Trump administration went to some lengths to try to dissuade countries from using Huawei and other Chinese telecommunications providers. They were the first ones to propose a ban on TikTok that was really meant to just go force a sale to the United States. These are all strategies that have found new life in the Biden administration. Now, I will say right up that Trump himself was not responsible for many of these, that he misunderstood his own strategy, that when H.R. McMaster drafted the national security strategy of the United States that came out the first full year of the Trump administration, Trump then went out and basically misdescribed it in a Rose Garden speech and immediately fell back to counterterrorism because it sounded big and tough. Okay. Biden has encompassed this in a much deeper policy that has involved engaging our allies, something Donald Trump's not known for, putting together South Korea, China, the Philippines, so that they are working together with the United States to basically do what the U.S. calls integrated deterrence. It put together the AUKUS deal with Australia that involves making sure that Australia has access to nuclear submarine technology, not nuclear armed, but nuclear powered. So these are all big elements of a long-term diplomatic strategy that may or may not survive whenever Joe Biden is no longer in office, but I suspect probably will survive. They also enacted something that the Trump administration talked about but never got going, which was the industrial policy that involves building up at home the semiconductor industry, protecting advances in AI and quantum computing, depriving China of the equipment to make the most advanced semiconductors. So they have executed on stuff that the Trump administration mused about internally, but never got its act together on. But there is definitely continuity there.
You explain that when President Biden entered office, it became clear that China had turned from a regional focus to a global focus. What was the primary evidence of this?
Oh, I think this happened before Biden came to office. It's just the degree to which we paid attention to it. The Made in China 2025 program, which is basically to make sure they could produce at home all of the key technologies they would need, started in 2015. We weren't paying attention. Congress in the CHIPS Act passed legislation to boost many of those same industries, but passed that legislation a year or two ago, not in 2015. The militarization of the South China Sea, the spread of the Belt and Road Initiative to try to buy off Pacific Islands, parts of Latin America, parts of the Arab world. It's been happening for 10, 12, 15 years to the point that people have already turned sour on some of the Chinese loans, right? That's how old the program was. And we were sort of living in this blissful, ignorance. Oh, people are going to want to go with the United States. And the answer is they're not if you don't have a competitive product. You know, one of the clunkiest things I saw the Trump administration do was go around to American allies and threaten them with the thought that they would deprive them of U.S. access to U.S. intelligence if they bought Huawei gear. Well, what was it that the United States was prepared to offer them as an alternative? They didn't have one.
You discussed this concept that shapes the Biden administration's thinking called new geometry, which, as I understand it, is essentially thinking about how to join with partner nations on issues of common interests, even if there are disagreements over other governance issues. Could you describe how the Biden administration has employed this in the Pacific in its competition with China?
Look, the Pacific does not have an equivalent to NATO. There is no NATO structure in the Pacific, and there never will be, given the nature of the politics in the region. But rather than try to keep this series of bilateral relationships, U.S.-Japan, U.S.-South Korea, U.S.-Philippines, where America is the hub and there are all these spokes, but the spokes don't talk to each other because the South Koreans don't get along with the Japanese and the Philippines. Yeah, this all goes back to, you know, Japan's occupation of the rest of Asia during World War II and before. The administration rightly thought that they could create a whole new set of diplomatic initiatives, some of which were more heavily economic, some more heavily diplomatic, some more heavily military, and piece those together. And so they put together, you know, four major powers in the region, including India, in one set of dialogues. They have put together the Philippines and the Japanese. They mediated between the South Koreans and the Japanese. And the idea here was basically to have a number of institutions to which China was not a member that they could use to coordinate their diplomatic and economic work and eventually put the militaries together in joint training and so forth. And is it a perfect system? No. Is it as smooth as NATO? And NATO was hardly a smooth running machine. No. But I think it was an imaginative way to acknowledge that you need a different diplomatic architecture in the Pacific than would work with the Atlantic powers.
And you frame this strengthening of partnerships as part of this three-part squeeze on Beijing that the Biden administration tried to operationalize as it came into office. The other two components being rebuilding at home technologically and otherwise, and cutting China off from using U.S. services for its military and intelligence. Could you describe some of the specific policies that the Biden administration has used to advance these initiatives?
Sure, and their shortcomings as well. So let's start with the export controls. The one thing that Xi Jinping complained to Biden about most vociferously, both in phone calls and in their meeting last year around Thanksgiving in Riverside, California, was the nature of the American technology cutoff to China, which has kept the Chinese from being able to produce the most sophisticated microprocessors, those with 3-nanometer architecture or smallest. That's the size of the circuit lines in them. It's what Taiwan Semiconductor does so brilliantly and what China's been trying to replicate and has had a very difficult time doing. Now, the U.S. doesn't make the equipment there. So they had to go cut off the equipment through two other countries. One of them was the Netherlands, where ASML, a company that people outside the tech world may not have heard of very much, makes the most sophisticated equipment. These are machines that cost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that sit in the middle of a semiconductor fab and actually are used to etch this tiny circuitry. It's an incredibly rarefied technology. And to do this, President Biden courted the then Netherlands Prime Minister Rutte, and he would come take secret trips to the United States. They would twist his arm. They would, you know, talk to him about the critical need to be able to cut off China. And he did it. He wouldn't talk about it. When he was questioned about it in the Netherlands Parliament, he wouldn't even discuss his trips to Washington in public. And guess what? He is likely to end up as the next head of NATO. He's recently out of office, and he's so built up the trust of the Biden administration that he is probably going to end up replacing Jens Stoltenberg, who's retiring, as the head of NATO. The other side of this was Tokyo Electron, a Japanese company that relied on a lot of Chinese customers. And to get the Japanese government to get a major company to give up the sales and profits that come with it was a big deal. So that's on that side. But the other part of this was a Chiron industrial policy that no one wanted to call industrial policy. That's the $52 billion that they poured in through the CHIPS Act into the semiconductor industry. I doubt you could get that through Congress today, but they did make it work then. So those are two, you know, great examples. Gina Raimondo, the very activist commerce secretary, who many believe is one of the more appealing politicians that the Democrats have for a future presidential run, has been probably the hardest line on the Chinese in this regard. The other day when I was talking with her about a deal between Microsoft and a UAE company called G42 to invest in the United Arab Emirates' AI efforts, and thus AI efforts throughout the Arab world and beyond, she said something to me that was pretty direct. She said, look, in the emerging technology world, you cannot live in both the American camp and the Chinese camp, which is what G42 was trying to do before this investment. He said, you have to choose. You can either be in one camp or you can be in the other, but you can't live in both. And that has essentially been the policy of the Biden administration. This is, as I said, a lot more sophisticated than what Trump was doing. Trump's view was, well, I'll sign a great trade deal with the Chinese. And that's where he was headed until COVID came along and he needed somebody to blame. And all of a sudden it became the China virus.
Several times during the book, you referenced the views of the former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, about U.S.-China competition and later on drones. And one insight that I found interesting was you said that Schmidt viewed the CHIPS Act as moving at political speed rather than commercial speed. So according to Schmidt and others in his orbit, what would moving at commercial speed look like in tech competition with China?
Moving at commercial speed would mean having a regular source of government funding and interaction. You know, the CHIPS Act was like a one and done thing in the minds of many in Congress. Oh, we had a problem with our semiconductor industry. We put $52 billion into it. Next, let's go on to abortion or border issues or whatever is the hot action of the day. The Chinese view is one of constant efforts to both merge government money and private money. Now, there are a lot of people saying you're going to waste a lot of government money doing this. And my answer to that is, yeah, you're absolutely sure you are. But we waste government money on bad weapon systems that turn out not to work all the time. Think about the money we have spent on hypersonic missiles and not produce them. The difference is that there is still a mindset in Washington that does not exist in Beijing or in Moscow or even in some parts of Europe, that there is this distinction that semiconductors and AI are somehow, because they are dual use, a commercial product in which the government should not get involved, and then there are defense products. Well, let me give you this example, Matt. Let's pretend for a moment that instead of discussing government investment in the next fabrication plant, we're discussing competing with China by building 10 aircraft carriers. Now, I would never build 10 aircraft carriers. I think in the modern world, they're sitting ducks for small, cheap, hypersonic weapons, right? But we'll set that my view aside here for a moment. If you went to Congress and you said, we need 10 aircraft carriers to compete with China's expanding naval fleet, there'd be some complaining back and forth. But since it would create so many jobs in the United States, they'd say, sure. Now, the last aircraft carrier we built was the Gerald R. Ford. And after all the cost overruns and all that, it was $14, $15 billion to build this one aircraft carrier. So 10 of them, let's say with inflation, let's say we spent $200 billion. Now, supposing you went to Congress and you said, we need to compete with China $200 billion of seed money to build semiconductor plants around the country so that we are no longer dependent on Chinese or Taiwanese semiconductors and the product of Taiwan Semiconductor, not because we don't trust the Taiwanese, but because they're so vulnerable living 100 miles off the Chinese coast. I think you would have people standing up and screaming, that's industrial policy. Well, yeah, it is. But if the chips are at the core of everything you build, your missile systems, your intelligence systems, your satellites and all that, it's also military policy.
There's clearly a bipartisan consensus that has emerged that there's a need to confront China in these areas. So what do you think it will take for that consensus to come around to industrial policy?
It did. It happened in the CHIPS Act, right? And the key to it, as I describe in the book, is that no one ever uttered the word industrial policy because it would send people fleeing from the room. And because you could make the case that you're creating jobs in Texas and New Mexico and Arizona, these are all places, and New York, these are all places where new fab plants bolstered by government investment have been announced. The bigger problem we're running into now is not the absence of money. It's the question of, do we have a workforce that can sustain these? I spent a lot of time with my longtime researcher and for this book co-writer Mary Brooks in Taiwan, and you'd go talk to the engineers in Taiwan, and they would sort of shake their heads about the factories that they were, the fabs they were building in the United States, because they said, "Look, if we have a problem on layer 17 of a chip, we stay here for 2 weeks and don't leave the office until it is done." Right? We go over to the United States and people say, well, we'll work on this to 5 o'clock and then I got to go pick up the kids from daycare. And this makes perfect sense to us in a world in which we're trying to balance jobs and family life. And the workers from Taiwan look at it like, are you crazy? We're in a huge competition here. You're staying in the office for the next 2 weeks until we get this problem solved, right? So it's just a completely different culture. And there are a lot of people in the Taiwan operations of Taiwan Semiconductor who have their doubts that they're going to be able to produce the same kind of chips and certainly at the same price point that they are producing them in Taiwan. And in fact, Taiwan Semiconductor has already admitted that the chips it is going to make in the United States will be more expensive. You will pay more for them, even though the function is the same as what you would get from Taiwan. We've got to figure out a way around that problem.
You explain that Taiwan Semiconductor may be a shield that might prevent an invasion of Taiwan from China for some time, but that this is a shaky assumption and perhaps one too dangerous to depend on. Could you explain how the Biden administration has thought about Taiwan Semiconductor as a shield and what that means for the defense of Taiwan more broadly?
So one of the reasons we were in Taiwan and spent so much time there is to try to figure out, does the silicon shield actually exist? And the Silicon Shield is the phrase used to sort of summarize the concept that China would never dare to invade Taiwan if it meant ruining Taiwan Semiconductor, this gem in the middle of the island. Because while it sells chips to the United States, it also sells chips to China that China can't make itself right now. And while the quality of those chips, or I should say the speed and the most sophistication of those chips, has been limited by U.S. sanctions, the fact of the matter is China wants the technology, the expertise, and the product that comes from Taiwan Semiconductor. I guess after spending a fair bit of time there, Matt, the conclusion I came to was this. Yes, the Silicon Shield is real for now because China has run into such troubles in trying to replicate this technology. But they're pouring a huge amount of resource into it, and sooner or later they're going to get there by sheer determination and technological advance. And as they do, the Silicon Shield is going to begin to erode. And one day, and we may not know when it comes, it will be eroded to the point that China may well be tempted to take the risk of taking over the island. Now, I'm not of the view that they are going to take the island by trying to do the giant crossing of the Taiwan Strait and the huge invasion. Those kind of naval operations to land on a shore, even one only 100 miles away, are very difficult. And the U.S. is going to extraordinary lengths that you'll read about in the book to go make it more difficult, putting robotic submarines at the bottom of the Taiwan Strait that could pop up and take out Chinese ships coming across. Same thing with drones and so forth. Not all of this is in place, much of it is not, but that's the plan. I do think that China may, over time, do the slow squeeze on Taiwan. Simply declare, this is part of China's territory, and therefore all products coming in and out of Taiwan need to be inspected, diverted to the mainland, basically do an embargo around the island or a cordon around the island that would make it clear that it's only going to survive as an economic entity as part of a single China.
And I want to, before turning to Russia, I want to ask a final question about the Taiwan issue. So you describe later in the book that the Biden administration has recognized that China is suffering from some significant weaknesses, in part because of U.S. policy toward China. These include China's slowed AI development, banks and property markets in crisis, demographic issues, many of China's highest earners emigrating from the country. And the Biden administration, it seems, thinks that this could delay an invasion of Taiwan because China's not in the position that it once was. But others have argued that perhaps China will see itself as a peaking power, and this could actually trigger an earlier invasion. So do you have a sense of where the Biden administration is on that spectrum of thinking?
I think they've moved. In the summer of 2021, they believe that the timetable for taking over China may have sped up. And we wrote about this, there were intelligence conclusions for it, because they were concerned that the more time that went on, the more the defenses for Taiwan would build up. And I think that view lasted through 2022 and the end of COVID. Now we've seen the economic downturn, as you referred to, and I think that has probably put time on the clock. And the reason I think so is if you're risking international sanctions and, you know, isolation, the way Russia had to face in the case of Ukraine, then you are in a world in which you need to have the highest economic growth that will sort of survive that period of time. Right now, they're at sort of 3% growth, maybe 4. That's a very different scenario than being at 7 or 8% growth.
Okay, let's turn to Russia now. So the U.S. seized Chechnya in 1999 and 2000, Georgia in 2008, Crimea in 2014. How could successive administrations continue to think Putin's aggressiveness would be constrained by economic incentives? How did national security officials in the U.S. justify these views?
They justified them over time by just subscription to the belief that at the end of the day, Putin would value the revenues that keep his country going and that therefore kept his political control largely unchallenged. And that he, in his view, keeping that revenue flowing was key to his survival in office. That view changed as the evidence arose that he was planning to invade Ukraine. And the book opens with a chapter called The Mother Lode, about the mother lode of intelligence that arrives in October of 2021, that in fact what Putin is preparing for is a full-on invasion. And you'll read the story of how they sent Bill Burns, the CIA director, former ambassador to Russia, the one in the administration who knew Putin best, to try to warn him of what would happen. That is where they started off. Over time, as they accumulated this intelligence, they made much of it public, leaked it to reporters like me and to the Washington Post and to the Wall Street Journal. We didn't publish it until we could confirm it separately, but still they were trying to peddle that. And then they were giving these deep intelligence briefings to the Europeans. And it was fascinating because the Europeans looked at this intelligence, they absorbed it, they understood what Putin was massing at the border. They didn't challenge that, but they didn't believe the U.S. thesis that this meant that Putin was going to invade. And up until the weekend before the invasion, at the Munich Security Conference in February 2022, they were insisting to me and others, this isn't going to happen. Don't worry about it. Not a problem. He's just bluffing. And there's a scene at the beginning of the book where I sit down and have breakfast one Saturday morning with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and we're comparing notes about leaders, European leaders, who have told us that for all of our concern, Putin will not pull the trigger. 4 days later, he invaded. It was a really humbling moment there. And look, for all of the failures of U.S. intelligence in Iraq, Afghanistan, I wouldn't excuse any of those. They got this one right.
So I want to go back a bit, and then we'll get back to the Munich Security Conference and what came after. But you describe how before the June 2021 Geneva summit, the U.S. had intelligence that Russia was building up forces on the border with Ukraine. But then Biden goes and speaks almost completely about ransomware. So what do you think Putin took away from Biden's choice in focus at that meeting?
So this was June 2021. In April, before this happened, Putin had built up along the border, and then, after getting a few warnings, but somewhat inexplicably, backed away, left his equipment there, but brought all the troops back. So by the time they met in June, 2 months later, the big issue that Biden was worried about was Russian ransomware hitting the United States. Remember, this was right after the Colonial Pipeline incident, which had a searing impact on Biden as he watched a commercial ransomware operation essentially shut down the movement of jet fuel, gasoline, up and down the East Coast. And you'll remember there were gas lines and the like, right? So that is what was going on at the time. So when he met Putin in Geneva, the number one issue on the agenda was to make the point, if this ransomware activity is coming from your territory, you're going to be held responsible for it. They briefly discussed Ukraine, but there wasn't an active threat against Ukraine at the time. One of the interesting questions is whether Putin, taking the measure of Biden, came to the conclusion, you know, this is a guy preoccupied by other problems, like getting the U.S. out of Afghanistan. Putin must have appreciated that because he remembered when the Soviet Union had to pull back from going into Afghanistan in the 80s, and that wasn't pretty easy either. I think Putin concluded from that, that Biden was somebody who was determined not to pull the United States into another war and would not challenge him in Ukraine. And I think Putin just got it wrong. I don't think he imagined the degree to which Biden was going to try to put together the allies and put together a coalition that would do everything except pour troops in. And Putin's been readjusting to that point. Now, he's gotten to the point now, more than 2 years later, where he has figured out how to go fight this war despite sanctions, despite the NATO training and intelligence. But it was not an easy thing for Putin to sort of digest at the time. And I think Putin misread Biden at the beginning.
And how much of that misreading do you attribute to a failure on the part of the U.S. to send the right signals, as opposed to just a misreading on the part of Putin of what the U.S. was likely to do?
I'm not sure that Biden knew what he was likely to do at that time. I know he wanted to pull the allies together, but wasn't sure the allies would pull together. Look, the Germans made it clear they would not stop Nord Stream 2 or Nord Stream 1 unless there was an invasion first. So it took an invasion to actually unify Europe.
So perhaps, yeah, and you say in the book that you think after Crimea, the invasion of Ukraine was inevitable. Is that because there wouldn't be another opportunity to send the right signals until there was another invasion? Is that what leads you to that conclusion?
I think that there was no way that Biden could demonstrate that he would be able to hold the NATO alliance together until the Russians rolled. Now we're in the reverse situation where it's the Europeans, particularly the Eastern Europeans, the former Soviet states, the former Soviet satellites, Poland, others, who are wondering whether it's the United States that will lose its resolve. We're almost in the reverse situation from 2.5 years ago.
And so another misperception on the part of the Russians came in the Russian initial surge in Ukraine. What didn't Russia anticipate, primarily or perhaps including in the cyber realm? You have some interesting insight there.
The accepted wisdom right now is that cyber didn't play much of a role in the war in Ukraine. That's a misreading of events. First of all, in the week leading up to the invasion, the Russians took out a satellite system that is used by the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian military. And they did it without ever attacking in space. They somewhat brilliantly cyber attacked the modems on the ground and froze this out. And the only thing that kept Ukraine alive then was Elon Musk providing Starlink, something that was not in the U.S. war plan, but now would be. And one of the things we've learned from this war is you need a vast distributed network of inexpensive satellites, not a couple of billion-dollar satellites that can be taken out. The second role that cyber played was that in the opening hours of the war, the Russians ran cyber attacks on Ukrainian government agencies. And that provided the warning, because once it got picked up by Microsoft, that went from Microsoft to Ann Neuberger, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology at the White House, to Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and fed into the early warning that the kinetic attack was supposed to begin. And now we have seen evidence of combined kinetic and cyber attacks in many of the cases what the Russians were doing to Ukraine. And let's not forget, Ukrainian cyber attacks on Russia to mess them up that have gone along with the Ukrainian drone attacks. It's just you can see the results of the drone attack on CNN or Russian YouTube videos, but you can't necessarily see the cyber ones. At the same time, cyber has not been the decisive factor here. And there's a quote early in the book from General Milley. It's one of my favorite quotes here. This is Mark Milley, who was the recently retired chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he said, you know, at the start, we thought this was going to be a cyber war. Then we thought it was going to be an old-fashioned World War II tank war. And then it became trench warfare. It was effing World War I. And the conclusion I come to is it was actually all three. It was 1914, 1941, and 2022 all wrapped together.
Well, one of the most useful parts of the book, I thought, was your description of the Biden administration's boil the frog strategy that it's employed during the war in Ukraine. Could you describe what that means and how the Biden administration has used it over the last 2+ years?
So the Biden administration has been criticized, I think with some merit, for not giving the Ukrainians all of our most advanced technology right away. And so you saw this pattern where Biden would say, I'm not going to provide X product, the F-16 fighters, HIMARS long-range artillery. The list goes on, tanks, because it will be so provocative to President Putin that it could trigger him to begin to employ nuclear weapons. And the debate inside the administration about the fear of escalation to nuclear is a theme that runs all through the book. But over time, he discovered that Putin had a much higher tolerance for what the U.S. and NATO allies were providing than he had predicted. And so they slowly began announcing, yes, we're going to give them HIMARS. Yes, we're going to give them cluster munitions. Yes, we're going to give them F-16s, or at least allow the Europeans to do it, and the U.S. will provide the training. Yes, we will give them longer-range weapons as long as the Ukrainians promise not to fire them into Russia. And that's been the boiling the frog, stepping up the temperature each time. And you know what? It worked for a while until now when the sheer mass of the Russian buildup has begun to overwhelm the Ukrainians at a moment that Ukraine has been running out of ammunition.
So you say the strategy worked. It's faced a lot of criticism from those who say that if the administration had moved faster with the transfer of some of these weapon systems, it may have allowed for more Ukrainian gains. And you describe this cycle in the book where the administration would go from a flat out no on the distribution of a weapon system to then studying it to then providing it. So do you think that 2 years on in the war, this process could have gone faster? Or does it seem that it really would have led to escalation in light of what we've seen from President Putin?
Really good question. One of those what ifs of history we'll never know. My own view is that many of these systems are so complex and require such training that I think had you dumped it all on the Ukrainians all at once, it would have overwhelmed them. You know, for the book, I went and watched the Ukrainians train at Grafenwöhr, this base that is in Germany, where Germany has trained its troops over the year. There are photos around of Hitler actually visiting Grafenwöhr during the training of Nazi troops. But since Germany's surrender in World War II, it's basically been a U.S. and German training base. And they brought thousands of Ukrainians there to learn how to do battlefield maneuvers and all that. But the training only lasted a few weeks before they had to go get them back to the front. And the fact of the matter is, much of it didn't stick. Do I think there are some things they could have done earlier? Yeah, I think if they had given them HIMARS long-range artillery earlier, it would have helped. Had we had more artillery shells ready, that would have helped. But the U.S. and its Western allies all greatly diminished the production of traditional ammunition, thinking, we're never going to see a land war in Europe again. And it's turned out that turning that flow back on has been much more complicated than they knew. So what are the big lessons here? I would have trained Ukrainians earlier. I would have revved up the old traditional arms manufacturing sector. But in the absence of an ongoing war, it would have been really hard to convince Congress to, I think, fund that. Because it would have been easy to say, I would have said, why are you building old, dumb artillery shells and you could be putting that money into cyber or anti-satellite weapons or the things we all know are going to be critical to the next conflict?
You also describe in detail the nuclear paradox that the Biden administration has dealt with throughout the war. You explain that the thinking within the administration is that the better Ukraine did, the more likely Putin would feel backed into a corner and might be tempted to use a nuclear weapon. And then the Ukrainians thought that the more Putin expressed a willingness to act aggressively, the less the West would back Ukraine. So how has the U.S. navigated this dance? And I mean, ultimately, the U.S. wants the Ukrainians to succeed. That's why we're sending billions of dollars. But at the same time, the President Biden has been equally committed to avoiding escalation. So how has President Biden straddled this seemingly impossible line?
It's been quite an experience because we have now actually seen for the first time in the modern nuclear age, a non-nuclear state, Ukraine, being threatened with the use of nuclear weapons by a nuclear state. And the peak of this came in October of 2022, when U.S. Intelligence picked up evidence that, in fact, the Russians may have been thinking about using a nuclear weapon. Let me read you just a short passage. It's on the back flap of the book, the back cover. And it'll give you a little sense of this. Joe Biden was standing in an Upper West Side townhouse owned by James Murdoch, surrounded by liberal New York Democrats who had paid handsomely to hear him. But his words on that night, October 6, 2022, carried a disturbing message. For the, quote, first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, Biden told the crowd gathered around Murdoch's art collection, we have a direct threat of the use of a nuclear weapon if, in fact, things continue down the path they've been going. The gravity of his tone began to sink in. The President of the United States was talking about the prospect of the first wartime use of a nuclear weapon since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and not at some vague moment in the future. He meant in the next few weeks. And that was because Biden had just gotten this series of highly classified signals intercepts that suggested that the commanders in Ukraine, the Russian commanders, were getting ready to roll out their weapons. And Biden said to the group at this fundraiser, I don't think there's any such thing as the ability to easily use a tactical nuclear weapon and not end up with Armageddon. So he was clearly haunted by this. His staff came to call this fundraiser the Armageddon speech. And they thought at that time that it was 50-50 a nuclear weapon would be used.
That was quite the anecdote. I want to turn to some of your broader takeaways from the book. So you say in the epilogue that globalization is out. So why is globalization out? I mean, it could be that perhaps globalization has changed significantly, but you document carefully in the book that now there's this competition for strategic partners over different technological and economic initiatives. So why isn't that a different form of globalization instead of the end of globalization?
Globalization is out as a strategy for countries. We obviously still have, you know, internet communications around the world. We still have international trade around the world. We did before World War I, and we thought at that time that it would stop Germany from going to war with the rest of Europe. We were wrong. We had it again before World War II, and we've had it at moments since. The point I was trying to make here was these new Cold Wars we are in are very different from the old. In the old Cold War, there was no real major economic factor to this, right? We had one major military, largely nuclear competitor, the Soviet Union. We knew where everybody with launch authority lived. We could watch their weapons. There was a predictability to it. That's gone in this era, where we are at once dependent on China and they are dependent on us for all the reasons we discussed earlier. And yet we are no longer confident that that alone will keep us from going into conflict. And meanwhile, we are drawing a sort of new Iron Curtain around the world that is basically on somewhere in the border between Ukraine and Russia. And on the other side of the world, somewhere in the Chinese sphere of influence in Asia and our own. And we're contesting where those lines are. Nobody thought those lines would even exist by now. And that is, to draw us back from to where we started, that is the result of this miscalculation about where globalization was taking us. Do I think it's dead forever? Not necessarily. These things come and go in waves. But for the next few decades, we will be engaged in superpower confrontation. And it is our great hope and should be the American mission from turning that into superpower conflict. One key element to doing that is to figure out how to handle the growing partnership between Russia and China. That's the partnership that Nixon and Kissinger were trying to avoid when they initially put together the opening to China. And here we are, roughly five decades later since that opening, with exactly the combination that we were trying to avoid. I interviewed Henry Kissinger a number of times for his obituary that appeared in the Times when he died last fall. And we talked about this at the end of his life. And he was quite explicit that his big concern was that Russia and China were now coming together in the way that he thought he and Nixon had forestalled.
One key strength that you say the U.S. and the West have over Russia and China is the power of the U.S.-led alliance structure. So could you, not to force you into the prediction game, but could you speculate about the effect that a U.S. commitment to this alliance structure would have for this new era of Cold Wars versus a departure from that alliance structure and a return inward?
So I was living for 3 months at the beginning of the year in Berlin, filling in the Times Berlin Bureau. And this is the constant source of conversation in Europe among leaders trying to map out what the world would look like under Donald Trump, right? Because if you believe that he actually doesn't value the alliance structure, and clearly he's made pretty clear his views on that, and if you think that America would not necessarily come to the defense of all NATO countries, particularly those that don't pay up 2% of their GDP, and I would argue they're going to need more than that to get done what they need to get done, then they have to begin to think of a completely different structure of defense themselves and may have to think about their own nuclear weapons. That's the fundamental choice in the foreign policy world in this coming election, between a president who's completely invested in the alliance structure that was built after World War II and a president or former president who wants to be restored to office, who fundamentally believes that the allies are largely chumps who don't have American interests at heart. They don't. They've got their own national interests at heart. And that the U.S. just needs to be powerful enough to operate in the world by itself and behind high walls. I think history's been pretty clear about what happens every time we retreat, but that, I think, is the fundamental foreign policy choice that voters are going to be confronted with.
And as is tradition on Chatter, I will finish up with a question from our Chatterbox. Who is a mentor of yours that influenced your work as a reporter perhaps your work on New Cold Wars?
It's a really great question. I would say it goes back to two of the professors who I had in college, Joe Nye, who, of course, is known as the creator of the term soft power, and Graham Allison, who studied the Cuban Missile Crisis, wrote a great book about it. I have the pleasure of teaching with Graham now for the past 15 years in the course that I took there. I think they helped shape my early thinking about this. I had some really terrific editors along the way who nurtured that along when I got to the New York Times. Bill Keller, among them, a former executive editor of the Times, but he was hardly the only one. And they've all sort of encouraged my curiosity in this. And, you know, the main thing I'd hope that your listeners would take away about New Cold Wars is there are a lot of academic books on this kind of topic. This is a book of reporting. This is a narrative story of how we got from where we were at the end of the Cold War to today. And I hope a framework for thinking about where we're going.
David Sanger, thank you very much for joining us and for your excellent book.
Thank you.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter @ThatWasChatter.